Today's episode of Gluck Radio is proudly brought to you by Audible.com. Audible.com is the premier provider of digital audiobooks, offering titles in every genre. Now, I want you to go and get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/gluckradio. There are over 150,000 titles to choose from your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. If you're a fan of this show, you might like to download American Savage by my fellow podcaster and sex advice columnist, Dan Savage. Or how about Crush It? Why now is the time to cash in on your passion by Gary Vaynerchuk. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/gluckradio. Again, that's audibletrial.com/gluckradio. Welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. Her fetish is not leather, but love. Her stated goal is to change our culture. And if she has to do that one sex party at a time, well, that's her way of doing it. She's one of the biggest sexual icons in San Francisco, and yet she really orgasms. For her, it's not about sex. Who is this walking contradiction? None other than Polly Superstar. And she's here on Gluck Radio to share her story. From the edge of modern sexual culture by way of London, her liberal ideas of millennial sexuality and relationships clash not just with society, but actually within her own heart. In her struggles between sexual freedom and individual romance, she criticizes and solves, or attempts to, her own cultural sexual hang-ups. Is she a source of enlightenment for a tepid culture, or is she a dangerous force? She's here for you to decide. Joining us will also be Mark Darien. Polly, welcome. Polly, welcome to my show. I really appreciate, in fact, I really, really appreciate you coming onto the show. It's a topic that's incredibly controversial and so necessary because it preoccupies 50 to 80% of both men and women's minds, depending upon their age and health. So,
where did you get that statistic from?
I don't know, I just made it up.
I think it's more like 100%, really. Yeah. Even if you're a 95-year-old woman with one tooth.
Yeah, well thank you for having
now,
me on.
Now we already know where Mark is, so we're going to... So let me ask the first question.
Yes.
Okay. Are you trying to, in what you have gone through, it's a long question, have and share with us your own experiences... Or is this a form of a civil rights movement where you're trying to actually get people to understand that there can be something healing, fun, and doesn't have to be labeled as unnatural to be not sexually monogamous or to have more sexual adventure? Like, what is in telling the story really down deep inside of your heart? What are you trying to accomplish?
Wow, that's a big question.
I know, talking, and you have a brilliant accent, so let's go.
You're talking about, you know, culture's relationship to morality and where are we moving to in as we step out of being controlled by these hierarchical systems that have told us what's right and wrong into a more global culture where we are living side by side with neighbors who have different beliefs from us and who we are supposed to respect their beliefs. Well, if we respect their beliefs, then we're going to be critical about the beliefs that we were raised with. And I'm not going off onto a religious tangent here, but religion has affected sexuality.
Absolutely.
And I want you to
go off as much as you want, because the truth is the religion sexual codes, I strongly believe they were moral when they were made because of the prevention of disease and of children being born without a safety net, and they prevented more problems than they created. But that, those needs are no longer really relevant.
You know? I mean, we've been living in a culture driven by shame and fear. And we are now having the consciousness to be able to look at our culture and say, hey, I'm going to make different choices. I choose to not be driven by shame and fear, and instead to be driven by the quest for happiness, for fulfillment, for enlightenment, for understanding of my fellow neighbors, and for peace and love. And I sound like a hippie now.
Or just driven by boners. Or that. That works too.
Well, see, that's now let's go to Mark's statement. Is there a philosophical end to this, or is there just a sexual drive where at the end of the day, if you have a pretty decent sex drive, that you just want the experience?
Well, and I think the thing is that people are obsessed with sex because they're not getting enough of it. We should be, as human beings, having more sex than most people are having. And so we feel frustrated, and we're all driven by this sense of frustration and longing and yearning and wanting, because it's actually really natural for us to be having way more sex than we're having. And so those urges, actually, when you're having more sex, kind of go away. Like, if you're being sexually satisfied, then you're not going to be spending as much time fixating on sexuality.
Yeah. But nobody thought about more sex than I did when I was 16 years old in my parents' basement,
and it's
freaking the fuck out.
Yeah, and it's completely natural. And at that age, you should be experimenting. At 16, you should be going out. You should be experimenting. You should be having lots of sex with lots of women who are also very open and wanting to have sex and experiment and explore, because that's a really rich time.
But Polly, wouldn't you add that at 16, okay, because I, you know, not proud of it, but I don't remember, you know, as a teenager wearing condoms. I don't remember caring about condoms. If the opportunity was there, I was going to have sex. So, meaning, isn't there some sort of responsibility necessary for, if you're going to play and explore and experiment, that you need to at least realize there are always consequences to every action, whether they're good or bad?
Of course, yes. I'm part of the AIDS generation, you know, like I was raised with those really scary ads on TV telling us to have safe sex. I was raised by a sex therapist as a mother, who was very open about sex and really talked to me about stuff. I went to a very liberal school where I was taught to put condoms on vegetables. They had zucchinis in the science lab, and we were actually taught to physically put condoms on.
That must have disappointed
like,
you with a lot of men you were with.
Zucchini's intimidating. 14, that is anti-male
15
bias.
15 years old. So I think that more conscious connection to sexuality and more conscious awareness about sexual culture will naturally mean that younger people are given more opportunities to understand how important safety is and how important it is to be aware of STDs and of unwanted pregnancy. And of course, yes, but that shouldn't be stopping them. See, in the past, we were stopped by shame. Don't do that. That's bad. It's wrong. And so kids just didn't do it, and you end up with these frustrated teenagers in the basement jacking off. And
yeah, that's me.
Not,
you got it.
And not actually
did you read my diary?
And not actually having their sexual needs met, and ending up having really weird relationships to their sexuality because they're not being able to express themselves.
But Pauline, let me ask you this question. It's kind of interesting. You've had a lot of sex in your life, correct?
I have, but I'm not. It depends on where you are on the scale, you know?
I mean, we've had a lot,
maybe a lot is a healthy amount.
Okay,
right. I think I've had a healthy amount of
sex.
Put
it this way.
That's how I say it.
And yet, you've not experienced too often orgasm. Where's the connection to that?
Well, I don't think that there's any connection between those two things. I think that my early relationship to my orgasm, which was really a struggle and a very a huge part of my early sex life, was more to do with the trauma that I was experiencing as a teenager, because I was in this really tough situation with my family. My father was very, very ill for a long time, and he was in hospital from the age of from when I was 9 to 16, and that's really when you're like opening, becoming a teenager and becoming pubescent and learning, and all of this stuff is opening up. And I think that I was just, this is my theory, is that I was just so stressed out and just so filled with trauma that like it just wound tightly around me, and I just couldn't experience that expansiveness and that release. I was very kind of open-minded as a teenager sexually, and I was very explorative, and I was very interested in finding out, you know, what it was all about. And so I feel like I had a really healthy relationship to sex. And I know that a lot of people experience not orgasming because they have an unhealthy relationship to sexuality, because they're uptight, or because they feel shame and fear and all of this stuff around their sexuality. I wasn't one of those people. I was somebody who was had a very healthy attitude around sexuality, but still couldn't orgasm. And I think that there's a kind of misunderstanding in our culture these days that women who can't orgasm are uptight. This is kind of like a theme, you know, that we're like that. There's that we should just loosen up.
You like, know what? I'm going to step into Polly for a second, Dr. Gluck's shoes, and be Dr. Gluck. I completely agree with you that it has nothing to do with being uptight. But there is the possibility, because later on in my life, for me personally, I had to have some sort of intense emotional connection when it came to sex, that just random sex just didn't do it for me, even though, you know, I always found myself in a position of desire without the connection of some feelings. And sometimes as I grew older, it had to be really intense feelings in order for me to really enjoy the pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. I think sexuality is all about connection. And the idea that someone is promiscuous, therefore meaning that they don't have those connections, I think is inaccurate. I think that you can be promiscuous in a very loving way and in a very connected way with people, with multiple people who you're having relationships with. I don't think it has to be necessarily that you're just having like cheap kind of throwaway sex all the time just because you're having a lot of it.
Now, you are a legend in San Francisco for your parties. Tell us about your parties. How did it begin? Who did you invite? How did this thing just come about?
Okay, well, I started off, I used to be a latex fashion designer way back in the day, making kinky clothes. And I arrived in San Francisco and started my own business here, and found this beautiful space that was way too big for me. And so I had this idea to like create some kind of sex positive art community in this space, but I had no idea how to do it. And my first steps was to start throwing these events. And I threw the events primarily because the space was expensive and I needed to cover the rent, and also because there weren't that many parties happening in San Francisco that were like fetish, really dressed up fetish parties. And I wanted to create demand for my own product, which was the latex clothes, by throwing these events where people could wear the latex clothes.
Sex She's person. A businesswoman. She She's doesn't a, care about sex.
Exactly.
This is
entrepreneurial.
Okay. It was completely entrepreneurial. And then what happened was I fell in love. I fell in love with the community that showed up at my door, and everything changed for me. And they're the ones that taught me the value of sexuality being expressed within community. And it was something that we grew into together. So we all kind of fell in love at the same time and kind of grew this thing together, which was really, you know, nothing that had experienced.
I actually want details. Did it grow because there was a general sense of acceptance and people with fears and anxieties just lost them? I mean, did it grow because the connection went from sex to sex and love? Like, what happened? How did it grow?
Okay, well, at the very beginning, it was more of a fetish party. The very first kinky salon was an after party for a big fetish ball that was happening in San Francisco, and it was very kink-oriented. There were no beds anywhere. It was just this kind of more of a fashion-y kind of event. And then after that, we started throwing them on a regular basis every month. This was me and my partner, Scott, who started the events with me. And we started throwing them every month. And we started to notice things like the couches and the soft areas. People were really attracted to them. They were filled really early with people making out. And we were like, huh, we should bring in more, like, soft, loungy areas. People are really enjoying this. And then we would throw, like, a costume party, like a theme. Instead of it just being a kink party, we'd be like, let's all dress as superheroes. And everyone would come out. It was crazy. They loved it. And so what I did was I gave the people what they wanted. I looked and I saw what made people happy, and I just continued to do those things. So, oh, themes make people happy. Okay, well, let's do that every month. And then afterwards, I look back at these things and I can see why, as analyzing it, you know, historically, but I didn't know at the time. It was all just intuitive, and it was all just giving
Holly,
the
it sounds
what
to me
wanted.
like what you did is create a community, and what became really intense is people were coming to meet their brothers and sisters, you know, who they could have great incest with without any guilt.
Well,
that's loaded, but yeah, I think I get what you mean. Right. They're metaphoric brothers and sisters. We're not turning this into a big taboo thing.
Yeah, you're making us sound like some kind of California sex cult.
But let's be honest. Let's be honest. That's kind of, you know, I think what's so funny about this discussion is everybody who lives in San Francisco is listening around long and thinking, yeah, what's the big deal with this and everybody else mm-hmm. in the country? Because I used to live in San Francisco.
And it would not be weird.
It would not be weird to see a guy walking down the street masturbating with like a Gimp mask on. You'd be like, oh, yeah, that's happening. Anyways, back to work. But in Ohio, where I'm from, I don't know.
Kinky Salon might have been born in San Francisco, but there are now events happening in 10 cities all over the world, including New York and London and Copenhagen.
So is it really a business, or is it community building?
It's community building, yes, absolutely. I share the tools of how to throw a kinky salon with the local kinky salons.
And what are the rules? Everything has rules.
No. I mean, the tools, I said, not the
no,
rules.
No. I'm asking, what are the rules of the kinky salon? Like, do we accept men and women who are married and their spouses don't know? I mean, do you have certain rules that you ask the people to play by?
Well, that's not a specific rule, but we call them agreements, because to say rule means that there's some kind of top-down hierarchy telling you what to do. Agreements is what the truth of it is, because these are things that the community has agreed to uphold. And so there are things like within the space of Kinky Salon, there are things like don't get too drunk. Don't get too drunk.
Okay.
Don't get too drunk. No, we're grown ups. Okay. We're allowed to have a cocktail.
Okay.
But like, if you're staggering around, we'll kick you out. Don't cruise aggressively. So in a lot of these kind of sex positive environments, it's really problematic for women who are basically just under fire all the time from men who are like being too aggressive with them. And at these parties, we don't allow that. Like, even if you're staring at someone too much, you'll get kicked out. So
Holly, you're taking away
my
bread and butter here. This is how I subsist. Okay.
Good.
So these agreements, what they do is they create an environment that's really safe and really fun to explore. Of course there's consent as well, like don't touch anyone without asking. But one of the things that I think creates a really unique space at Kinky Salon is what we call the PAL system. And PAL stands for Pervy Activity Liaison. And basically what this means is that you come to the event with a person. That person can be your date, or it can be your friend, and they can be of any gender, and you don't have to be there to be with them. You can arrive at the party and then go hang out with other people. But you are responsible for your pal, and they are responsible for you. And so what that means is we have distributed accountability in the event so that everybody has somebody that they're keeping an eye on. And the problems don't even happen.
Holly, you're drunk and you are doing the kinkiest things in the world with everyone and anyone you want to. And you're thinking, I wonder what the other guy's doing?
Well, yeah, you have to be because you're going to be held responsible
for
their
behavior. Yeah, it's the buddy system. It worked in third grade on a field trip. It works when you're getting pegged by a 12.5-inch dildo.
Exactly.
Over some swing or something.
If you notice...
Why don't we just set up all society with the buddy system? I think we'd all be a lot better.
Yeah, I mean, I have people who come up to me during the event and say, hey, you know what? My pals are acting a bit weird. I'm going to get them out of here before I even realize that there's a problem. You know, these people are keeping an eye on each other because their standing in the community will be put at risk if their pal breaks the rules.
Yeah.
All right. So if their pal, by the way, breaks the rules, are they banned from the next event?
No, not necessarily. I mean, it depends on what happened. Every case we do individually, there's no hard and fast rules about anything because everything is always, there's always
the
a
hard
story.
Hard and soft
there's
is not a pun, right, Polly?
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, it's a complicated business running a community. But we very rarely actually kick people out. Most of the time, either we'll give them feedback, and they'll be so annoyed and insulted by the fact that we made commentary on their behavior that they never come back. Or they thank us and they say, wow, thank you for that reflection. I'm really appreciative that I didn't realize I was doing that. And I really appreciate it. I'm going to keep, you know, I'm going to work harder. It is like therapy.
Polly, what drugs are permitted and what drugs are completely off the limit that you just won't tolerate?
Well, I mean, that's a really difficult question. I wouldn't tolerate any drugs being publicly consumed at my parties. There's no, like, doing blow off each other's tits or anything. You know, that doesn't happen at Kinky Salon. It's
how about sushi?
I think doing blow off a body part is more of a New York thing anyway.
No, but okay, so what drugs are allowed?
I mean, yeah, well, there's alcohol. Okay. We have a BYO bar. And in California, medical marijuana is legal, and so we have an area that's a smoking area that people, if they have their medical marijuana, they are welcome to smoke that. But apart from that, I mean, it's not really a druggy scene. I mean, I'm sure there are some people who are like on E, or the amount of energy that's generated by a massive amount of people all having sex, even if you're not in the room with them, even if you're like next door, it's kind of like the kundalini like swirling around the building is enough to make you feel high without even having any drugs. And often what happens is people get too drunk or too high because they haven't catered for that. It's kind of like being on a boat. You know when you're on a boat and you get drunk and then you're like, whoa, and you feel way more drunk than you would be on solid land. It's kind of like that at Kinky Salon.
What happens to those who, in fact, find that they can't perform because of maybe repressed religious issues or repressed personal issues or body issues, so on and so forth?
What do you mean by can't perform?
No boner.
For the men, it's there's no erection, and therefore, the feeling of, look at every other guy, he's able to perform, and I am less than him. What like, does someone go over and kind of console them, or what happens?
Well, I mean, I think that there's lots of sex.
You're a health aid squad.
Just get in the Gatorade. That usually works.
There's lots of kinds of sex that you can have without having a boner, for a start. So there's lots of other things that you can do. You're not a failure as a human being if you don't have a boner. And also, I want to make it clear that the play space at Kinky Salon is not like performative. Like there's no people watching. Every single person who is in the play space is playing. And so we have a zero tolerance for lurkers and gawkers. If you're not having sex, then you'll be outside in the social areas, of which we also have many. So lots of people aren't having sex. Lots of people are just going to the party and having fun and dancing and flirting and exploring a space of openness and liberation and flirtatiousness with people without necessarily the normal cultural expectations. And then in the play space, there's people are all having sex in the same room, but they're not being watched by anybody. So there's not like a sense of pressure.
Now probably presently, are you married?
I'm not presently married. No.
Okay. Now, when you do get married, because I'm sure that's going to happen. How comfortable would you be with your husband in this environment?
I'm incredibly comfortable.
Okay.
Of course.
All right, so...
I mean, I'm not really the marrying kind. I mean, I was in a long-term relationship with my partner for 12 years. So, and we built Kinky Salon together, and we were around, you know, we have multiple relationships and dated other people and, like, watched each other in the play space at Kinky Salon. I mean, I'm a very open-minded, open-hearted person. And if I have a partner... or a husband or a boyfriend in that environment, then we just would have, we would just check in with each other and be loving towards each other and not be weird and not exclude each other and create a space where we can both feel safe and loved. Even
is there, by the way, is there like a form that people fill out to state that they're, you know, disease free and so on and so forth? I mean,
there are lots of people that come to Kinky Salon that have STDs. Of course, there are. The statistics of herpes and HPV are so high, we would be cutting out like a quarter of the population.
So do people wear stickers, you know, I have STD and I have, are there little buttons so you know what you're getting involved with?
No, everybody has a conversation. So there's a pretty standard practice within sex positive and polyamorous communities that before you interact with somebody sexually, you have a little chat about what their relationship status is and what their STD status is before you have sex with them. And then you just know what's going on and you know what's going on with everybody. And you just, each person has their own safer sex practices. Some people are comfortable, with oral without latex protection, and some people are not. They want latex for everything, and it's really up to the individuals. We don't enforce any safe sex practices. I think that there's a lot of stigmatization around.
So what you're saying is that you don't monitor those issues that you expect the people who are coming to be of a sound mind, that they will be honest enough to say that they're HIV positive or they have herpes or that they have STD.
Being HIV positive and having herpes are completely different ends of the spectrum.
Well, I know that, but what I'm saying is there's no paperwork to know what one has.
No, there's no paperwork. No. It's fine. Everybody's grown-ups. We also might have a cold, which is actually the most commonly sexually transmitted disease, is the common cold. And you might disclose that before you make out with someone, too. STDs have such a huge cultural stigmatization around them. They're just little infections like any other little infection that we might get, a sinus infection or pink eye or whatever it is. We're human beings. We're around each other in close proximity. We're going to get bugs from each other. It's a natural part of being a human being. The reason that STDs have such strong stigmatization around them is because people are ashamed of their sexuality and that they say, oh, that's dirty. You're dirty. You have herpes.
Polly, you would be right, except the fact that in the 80s, before there were all these cocktails, people died from HIV. People don't die anymore, but they did die. So I don't think it was about being too moral, because I was raised in a completely...
Yeah, but that's... No, I wasn't talking... I was talking about HPV, not HIV.
So why are we making HIV so different?
Why am I making HIV different from HPV and herpes?
Yeah.
Because herpes and HPV have a pretty much everybody who is sexually active has them at one point in their lives. I mean,
that's absolutely true, but they're doing the same thing to get HIV too.
But HIV isn't nearly as common. So if you're in a play space, it's very rare to encounter somebody with HIV, whereas it's very common to encounter people who have herpes, for example, or HPV.
So we're basically saying
common diseases, and they're also not—they don't harm you. Like they're just a little. It's just a little infection. It comes and goes. It's not a big deal. It's not going to kill you. You're not going to have to go on medication for the rest of your life. It's just a little thing.
I don't even want to think about how much HPV I have.
Mark,
don't wear that for your dating T-shirt.
Yeah.
Pretty much everybody in the world who is sexually active is comes in contact with HPV. And the stigmatization around STDs is part of the sex negative culture. And I think that, you know, once we, you know, certainly in a space like my events and Kinky Salon, people just don't, they're not as concerned, because they're like, they're not as ashamed of their sexuality, so they're not thinking these things are nasty. They're just taking them in their stride, like, whatever. I got a little infection from being in close contact with other human beings. It's part of being a human being.
I hate to keep pounding this, but aren't we, even though we are saying, and you're 100% right, Polly, that 99% of the population has herpes A, cold sore, and, you know, upon oral sex, it can become herpes B, and so on and so forth. But are we being a little bit naive in places like San Francisco and New York City that HIV is not that unusual?
HIV is preventable by using condoms.
Yes, but condoms.
So everybody in the play space uses condoms.
You don't insist on condoms at the party, do you?
Everybody in the play space uses condoms. Yes.
Is that a rule?
It's actually the law in San Francisco.
It is the law.
It was a law that was brought into effect in the 80s after, in the height of the AIDS crisis.
And I am sure the sheriff of San Francisco goes around, knocks on the door, and gives tickets to those who have not done that.
Well, they did close down a lot of the kind of bareback bars and, like, places where people were having really unsafe sex practices in the 80s in San Francisco. Yeah, sure, they closed everything down. And the only way to get the sex clubs reopened was to bring about these laws, which were enforced. I mean, originally in the 90s, in the power exchange, they literally had monitors going around with flashlights making sure that people were using condoms.
I want to be on that beat.
Well, you know,
I'm sure
right?
That helped for a sustained
yeah,
direction.
Sorry, honey, won't be back till later. I got to go to work again.
Yeah, exactly. Like, can you pull out for a second? I just need to... Thank you.
Now in and now out. Okay, now in again. Okay, hold it. Wait, hold that face.
I just need to double check. I mean, literally, that was what was happening in the 90s at Power Exchange. And it's not enforced like that anymore, but that was how they managed to keep a sex club open in the post-AIDS crisis San Francisco.
I want to go back to a little bit of your life. At 16, you... I think you had an experience in a sex dungeon. What was that all about?
Well, you know, I was a very rebellious young woman.
I couldn't
and
have told.
I was, I was trying to push my parents' buttons, which was very difficult because, you know, as I said earlier, my father was very sick and he was in hospital for, like, all this time, and it was a very traumatic family situation, and as a rebellious teenager, I had very little to push back on. They would basically be like, okay, whatever, Polly, do what you like. And so I, you know, started to do more and more outrageous things, and I discovered the fetish scene originally in the back pages of Skin 2 magazine, and found this party that was happening, and was like, I'm going to check that out. And it was really before any of the fetish clubs existed in London. It was a very small event in a bar that was actually kind of more like a British pub, you know. It was like very, like you know, kind of posters on the walls and extolling the virtues of drinking more Guinness and, you know, the guy behind the bar. Like, it was just it felt like a British pub. And it was very weird. And we were like, what is going on here? And then people kept asking us, do you want to go downstairs? And we were like, oh, I don't know, what's downstairs? And eventually we went downstairs and checked it out, and it was a dungeon. It was the first dungeon I ever saw, and it shocked me, but also kind of compelled me. It was like this really interesting space that I was really kind of fascinated by. Like, it was so, like, naughty and modern. You know, I was just like, what is this? I wanna explore it.
This
and
sounds
so,
like a dream you tell your analyst about.
No, continue.
And I went downstairs into a dungeon, and anyway.
No, I want to be the analyst. Keep on going. So what happened?
And so I went. You know, I was with a friend of mine, a girlfriend from school, and we peeked downstairs and saw this incredible display of sexuality happening in front of our eyes. Kind of BDSM scenes unfolding, and, you know, one person kind of strapped to a cross, and, you know, just these scenes. And at the time, I was really I was really shocked by it. Like, I didn't go all the way down the stairs. I turned around and went back up. I was like, whoa, you know, that was really intense. And part of me was like disgusted and like, oh God, ah. And the other part of me was like, I want to explore it. Like, what is this? It was like really compelling. And so I started going to more and more of these events where really it was about power dynamics and it was about expressing pain through sexuality. And these are things that I wanted to explore as a teenager. I didn't understand my reality as an adult. I found life to be very painful and very unfair. And I found that the BDSM scene was a place where I, for a start, was the place where I, the only place I had ever experienced in my life where I felt any kind of power, as a very powerless, you know, young woman, really just watching her father die very slowly, to be in a position where I felt like I had power. That was the first time in my life that sex was absolutely associated with power. And also a place where I could express my frustration, or I could express my pain, and all of those things. Like, it was a real playground for that for me. So, yeah.
Do you think that other people in the BDSM scene, they also come to it for those reasons? Or do each people have their own different
reasons? Everybody has their own reason. There's lots of different ways to come into the BDSM scene, and there's lots of different reasons for interacting with it. There are some people who are just interested in the stimulation of the senses, and that's just another way to stimulate the senses. And then there are some people who are seeing it more as a cathartic thing, where they're kind of working through stuff and seeing it more like therapy almost, where they go, they have something that they can't really express in their lives, and that they can go and fully express in that space without being judged, and without having to really talk. You know, it's like more like somatic healing, where it's like in the body rather than being about talking. And for me, that was really a powerful thing.
There was a tremendous amount of healing that you were able to both get and identify with. But I don't want our listeners to think that there's not the danger of sex as one of the most powerful addictive emotions that one could have. And I think that those with sexual addiction tend to ruin their lives quite faster than those with addiction to drugs or alcohol sometimes. So, meaning, is there a place where your community kind of talks about the dangers of just being too much, you know, involved in the community and maybe not taking care of their responsibilities of their health, home, bills, friends, and so on and so forth?
Well, you know, I think that sex addiction, I'm not sure that I really believe that is, for me, it's about creating a healthy environment for sexuality. And sex addiction comes from an unhealthy relationship to sexuality, right?
No,
so I'm talking about
No, Polly, that's like saying being around people who drink a lot creates alcoholism. Alcoholism is a disease. You could be around people that drink all the time and still be able to handle your alcohol. So I think that addictions are unique to people, and those around them may help throw gas on the fire, but it certainly doesn't create them.
I think that there's the picture of like an individual life within the current culture that we have, which is what you're talking about. I'm talking about like creating bigger structures and potentially even changing culture to create more healthy attitudes towards sexuality, not just creating a bubble of healthy sexuality within a world that is incredibly sex negative and difficult. I think that there's a lot of unhealthy relationships to sexuality, and I think most of them come from the fact that our culture has a really unhealthy relationship to sexuality. And so, you know, I think that I'm sure that there are people who have come into contact with Kinky Salon, and people might say that it ruined their lives. They might say that it ruined their relationships. But I don't think that that's necessarily true. I think that there are people who came into Kinky Salon and had their lives changed and had their perception of, understanding of what their relationships and sexuality meant to them and shifted, and that that was hard for the other people in their lives who they left behind.
Even if it was true that Kinky Salon ruined somebody's life, that's not really the fault of Kinky Salon. Like, it's not alcohol's fault that people become alcoholics.
And to be honest with you, it's not like a thing that I've heard of. Like, I've never heard of this happening, of like somebody's life being ruined because they were like addicted to Kinky Salon or addicted to sex and unable to control themselves.
I think you haven't been out that much. I mean, I'm doing
life coaching
for 37 years. Lots of people are. Yeah, their lives
I'm
are
sure there are in the world.
I think we're all getting caught up on that word addiction. I think really what you mean, Dr. Gluck, is people will sabotage their lives because of the sexual pleasures they get. Or they use it as an escape, and that's the problem.
I'll tell you why, again, I am going to stick to addiction, because I drink alcohol, you know, but I cannot drink. But a alcoholic who's crossed that line takes one drink, and he's going to black out.
Right.
Yeah, he's using it as an escape. But to fill whatever emotional disequilibrium he has.
But he doesn't have the choice not to stop once he starts.
That's where
addiction starts.
Yeah. Absolutely. And at Kinky Salon, at the community that I am the leader of, and at all of the Kinky Salons across the world in all the different cities, this isn't a common problem. So it's not something that I've heard of. If it was a common problem, I could say, oh, yeah, those people. Like, we totally have those people who come in and kind of act crazy and get totally addicted. But it hasn't happened. So I acknowledge that it might happen or exist in other places in the world and that it's something that's a problem for people. But it's not something that I've encountered. When you're talking about that in reference to Kinky Salon, I don't think it's related.
Polly, how many Kinky Salons are there around the world? How many people are actually involved?
There are 10 currently in different cities all over America and Europe.
And what would be the amount of people involved in each one approximately?
Involved in each one. Wow. Well, that's kind of difficult to say. Some of them have been going on for a really long time. There's core teams of volunteers for each one. You know, I'd say something like...
I mean, given at any one time. I don't mean the whole history.
Well, I mean, you're going to
Like if someone said, what's the membership of your church? You wouldn't say, well, since it was started in 1932, its membership is 98,000, even though 100 show up every Sunday. So, like, how many people walk through the door, you know?
Kinky salons are relatively small. They're usually about between 100 and 200 people at each event.
That sounds huge. I thought you were going to say, like, 25.
Okay, so 100 times 10 is 1,000 people, which is a lot of people, you know, but I'm assuming, Polly, and one of the things I want to make clear. I applaud any personal evolution in the ability to see and to accept that other people are human beings and they have a choice, you know, and they have a right to the pursuit of their own happiness as long as they're not hurting another person. So I am on the same page as you. I just think that there's a responsibility with freedom to make sure you don't take away another person's freedom and you're not hurting others. And to be aware that when you indulge in anything, even drugs, for some people alcohol is amazing, for others it could be a nightmare. You know, whether it's ecstasy or it's cocaine or whatever other drug it might be. So that's my only point.
I think you're making a great point, and part of what I always say about the reason that we are a community instead of just a party is that we take care of each other. And so if people are struggling in their relationships, or if we have lots of support, we have like support groups that meet and discuss opening up relationships and open sexuality, and we have social events where people can meet each other and get support from the community. So people aren't really doing it in a void. They're getting a lot of support from the community in participating.
What is the cost of membership?
What is the cost of membership?
Is there a membership cost?
It's different in each city. Each city is kind of self-contained. That you know, each city has its own production team and its own way of doing things that I don't really micromanage.
You're the CEO, so doesn't everything come back to you?
No.
Oh, so they're independent.
This kind of sounds like AA, but instead of talking to each other, you bone down. Instead of dealing with alcoholism, you deal with religious oppression.
Right, but AA has no cost.
It's a network.
But I think that's what she's saying, right?
It's a network that replicates the experience of Kinky Soul. Yes, people pay to get in the door, but that money doesn't necessarily come back to me. Like, I'm not
No, no, I'm not talking about you. I'm just curious. Like, what does it cost to get through the door?
What does it cost to get through the door? Somewhere between $20 and $40, depending on where you are.
You know,
that's not bad. Yeah, cheaper than therapy.
Yeah, cheaper than therapy and way more fun.
There's silence in this room. That's not quite possible. This is not really possible. Let me ask you the question. Could you see yourself doing this your entire life? You're how young?
I'm 40.
You
nobody
are
asks
40
a lady
young.
Their
great.
Age.
Well, you know what? That means nothing because molecular age is different than linear age. You could be 25. Could you see yourself doing this, you know, in your 60s and 70s?
Good question. I don't know. I don't know how I'll feel in my 60s and 70s, so it's impossible to tell the future. I think possibly. I definitely reached a point a few years ago where I got really burnt out on throwing events, but that was because I was having them every weekend and it was in my home. And I definitely reached a breaking point of like, I never want to do this again. And now I'm back at the point where I'm like, oh, this is really fun. I throw a monthly party in San Francisco and I manage all of the other events around the world. And it's much more fun again. So it depends on where I'm at.
I could see you getting really tired of cleaning up disgusting stains.
I'm sure she
has. What's the grossest thing you had to clean up? Let's get real.
You know what? At this point, I'm so used to picking up used condoms with a rubber glove, like, it totally doesn't bother me. And there's a lot of people in my team, too, who do that. Like, I'm not the one at the end of the night cleaning up the used condoms. Most people use the trash can, thank goodness. It's funny because it's a question that people ask often, like, doesn't it smell really bad? And I'm like, no, it smells like people having sex, which actually smells kind of nice. It's like all the pheromones it's not funky. Although, isn't that the definition of the word funk originally?
Yeah, so maybe it, absolutely.
Maybe
it is.
It's funky, but in a good way.
Yeah, it's kind of like how you like the smell of your armpits after you get back from the gym, because it's like you, and it's like comforting in a way. Even though it doesn't smell good, it's comforting.
You know, through sexual activity, where do you see this becoming more growing out to more of a movement, and what do you see the next stage being for you and for the movement?
Well, I think that the sexual revolution is something that continues. It's something that humanity has always had a challenging relationship to sexuality. It's a problem that we've been working on for many centuries. It's been a source of difficulty for us, and it's complicated. And, you know, even way back as far as, like, the Age of Reason and the Enlightenment, people were first starting to question morality and be like, why am I being told what's right and wrong? And becoming libertines and trying out new things and creating their own moral structures. And I think it's something that continues. Humanity's relationship to morality continues to change. Morality exists as a way to kind of control culture in what is ultimately like a kind of a not very natural environment for us. So we're supposed to be living in tribes, you know, and wandering around and in groups of no more than 150. So the fact that we live in these incredibly complex urban environments, kind of multicultural.
Why are we supposed to be living in tribes of 150?
Well, no, I'm not saying we're supposed to. I'm saying that
that's
we,
how
we did
evolved.
as hunter-gatherers.
But even in those tribes, there is sexual repression. I mean, the alpha male would beat up the smaller males.
No, that's not actually true.
Yeah, I mean, they'd kill off 30% of the males before they hit puberty.
That's Are you talking about human hunter-gatherers?
Yeah, I'm talking about human hunter-gatherers and Aboriginal tribes now.
Well,
I mean, it's not all roses and sunshine.
I think it's very difficult to say finite facts about what happened in our prehistory because we don't have direct evidence of it, and it's one of those things that's always going to be a question. We're always going to be questioning. But one thing that we do know is that as hunter-gatherers, our tribes were about 150. We know this because of the size of our frontal lobes, which is a direct correlation with other primates. We can tell the scientists have discovered that the brain size is exactly related to the tribe size. And so that's kind of something finite that we can see in our physiology. And so I'm not making any statements about anything else about our sexuality, just that we're now living in more complex environments than we did as hunter-gatherers.
Yeah. I just want to go through the last answer. And where do you see the next evolution of your own communities?
Well, you know, I'd like to see kinky salons becoming more culturally accepted, where instead of being something that a lot of people can't talk about, instead being something that's more just like normal, like, oh, I went to a bar this weekend. Oh, I went to a kinky salon this weekend. That it's just something that people do. For that to shift, there's going to be some changes in our culture that are going to have to shift. And I don't know if that will be soon or far away, but do you think
sometimes a blowback that people who in fact are sexually in their minds liberated look down on people who believe in monogamy and abstinence?
Well, I think that's part of the movement that I'm really behind is this idea of choice. And so if you choose to be abstinent or if you choose to be monogamous, that's equally valid to the choice of exploring. Whereas in the past, we didn't have a choice. Now all I'm saying is we have a choice, and this is one choice. So I think that there are some people in the world who think that multiple relationships and being open sexually is like more evolved. But I don't think that's true. I just think that humans are all individuals and they get to make their choices about these things. And as long as they're not harming other people, that they can make decisions about their own morality and decide what they believe is right and wrong rather than having it imposed on them by a structure like religion or even just social values, you know, that each person is making their own choices. And the reason that this is coming about now is because of globalization and because, you know, previously we were told what our right and wrong was from when we were children, and now we're being given these different options and being able to think critically about our own morality. And I think it's a brand new thing for humans to really be able to have those kinds of choices.
Polly, I want to thank you so much for a stimulating, interesting, and necessary discussion. Your desire, you know, to take us, you know, to the next level of consciousness and to be open to those who feel they need to remain in their own consciousness is definitely noteworthy.
Thank you.
So thank you so much, and we'll speak to you soon.
Yeah, it was fun.
Thanks, Polly.
I want to once again thank Polly Whitaker for coming on to our show. Pick up a copy of her book, Polly, Sex Cultural Revolutionary, on Amazon, and visit polysuperstar.com. Also, check out Mark Darian's blog, animusempire.com, and be sure to buy a copy of his e-book, Man's Guide to Anxiety. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, and remember, to every problem there is a solution. I am your problem solver. Check out our other episodes on gluckradio.com and on YouTube at Errol Gluck, and visit my website at glucksolutions.org to learn more about how clinical hypnosis and executive life coaching will change your life. Life is precious. Time is precious. Don't waste it. Thanks for listening. Till next time.